The Night Hops podcast is intended for you, but not your children. My dad and Matt say bad words in this episode, which isn't good for kids like me to hear. Listener discretion is advised.
Okay, I am rolling.
Nighthawks, The Return, the covered movie film, will be Barbie, a film we have every business watching. And we are going to begin the record in 3, 2, 1.
Times are uncertain. Things are going on. But we are here. We're still here in some capacity. We don't know what that capacity is. We don't know when we'll be back. But we're here now.
Times may be uncertain, my friend, but one thing isn't. And that's that life is fantastic wrapped in plastic. If you're Barbie, if you're Laura Palmer, it sucks.
She's dead, wrapped in plastic. Do you know how long it took me to figure out that Jack Nance, who plays that character in Twin Peaks, is also the protagonist in Eraserhead?
I was today years old, so.
Oh, well, good. I feel a little better.
Yeah. I respect however long it took you.
I have seen Twin Peaks now probably 5 or 6 times in toto. I still have only seen Eraserhead once. I didn't dislike it. I'm not avoiding it. But there's not a week or a month that doesn't go by since I first saw Eraserhead where I don't think of Eraserhead. And that can be a little scary. Especially since I saw it over 25 years ago now. And so that's a long time for a movie to stick with you. So props, David Lynch. You made some endearing art. But
I mean,
the power of that art frightens me.
Eraserhead does bother a person, but it's no Tetsuo the Iron Man.
Or it's not that movie we don't discuss from Serbia.
The Chernobyl Diaries?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Nighthawks Podcast, your cinema-centric podcast for folks who like to stay up late and talk about movies. Have yourself a slice of pie and a cup of coffee because we are here with you now to talk about a movie. And I am Trevor T. Trujillo, film critic and museum employee, and with me in the booth as always.
Is me, Matt, the other guy. I do not work at a museum.
Film critic, stand-up comedian, what don't you do?
Windows. I'm a Linux man.
You went obvious and then put a twist on it. I like it.
I mean, it's an open-source operating system, Trevor, and it has all the functionality of Windows. The only reason it's not more well-supported is because it's not more well-supported. I'm pretty sure that 2024 will be the year of Linux on the desktop.
We will see. I have not a dog in that fight, but the dog that I do have a fight... the fight that I do have a dog in is what we've been doing lately. It hasn't been the podcast. We apologize. So, Matt, what have you been up to lately?
Not a heck of a lot, but not a heck of a little either, you know. Kind of my usual thing. Okay. Have some things in the fire, you know. Got my script in front of a guy from Canon Films the other day.
Not bad. You have a script?
I have a script that would be appropriate for Canon Films.
Well, I mean, that's great. Is it missing an action six?
It's called Monkey with Nunchucks.
Cut this man a check.
Here's the kicker. You're thinking of like maybe a chimpanzee with the traditional Japanese Okinawan weapon of 2 sticks connected by cord or chain. This is actually more of a King Kong Mighty Joe Young sized monkey. And he throws entire nuns.
Oh, he chucks them.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. He's in a convent. He's nunchucking. There's a Godzilla, and the Godzilla is fortifying an orphanage. And the real losers are the people of rural Italy.
Mom! Mamma Mia.
It's set in Italy because the full moon guy has a castle we can use.
Well, folks, the reason I mentioned that we're not quite sure when you're going to see us again, life is getting in the way. It's a hobby podcast. We do what we can. Typically around this time is when we'd be doing our Oscar death race, which I have not done much of at all. And we are going to endeavor to bring you some kind of Oscar coverage this year. It may happen, it may not. But just in case we don't get another bite at this apple, we decided to talk about a Oscar-nominated film. And it's one of the front runners. It's been the subject of a lot of pre-awards controversy after they announced the nominations. So we felt that this one was ripe for some grist, and we are checking out Barbie, 2023 film starring Margot Robbie and the baby goose Ryan Gosling.
She's English. It's pronounced Margot.
I thought she was Australian.
I don't know. I don't even know if her name actually has a T at the end.
It does have a T at the end, but you do not pronounce it. Gal Gadot, on the other hand, you do. Well, I think when we're talking about Barbie, it's a fairly recent film, so we're going to do our best to deploy our traditional spoiler curtain, have a little conversation in front of that curtain for folks who haven't seen the movie yet, who want to check it out, and then we'll give you a verbal warning when we're about to drop some spoilers, and then we'll talk about the film in toto. But for right now, Matt, do you have a history with Barbie? We're a little outside the traditional femme child demographics. So how in lane was this for you on the pitch?
I reenacted Attack of the 50-Foot Woman with G.I. Joes and a Barbie a couple times. Although I guess to scale, she's more of like an 18-foot woman.
Was it your Barbie though?
No, it was like a house I stayed at after school for a while during the latchkey era. It was a big family and it was about 2/3 girls. We had the occasional E-Man would flex for Barbie, and Barbie would be like, "Yeah, nice lats, but you only come up to my shoulder, you know. Sorry, short king."
He didn't even come up to her shoulder. The size difference between the two flagship Mattel toy lines was ridiculous in the 80s.
Well, Barbie is very elongated. Like, she's like over 6 foot to scale in heels, right?
Right. And notoriously, apparently, the toys... And I don't have a huge history with Barbie, so I never noticed this, but she's like really out of scale with a lot of her accessories. And a little note that I picked up from IMDb trivia, that is reflected in this film. They made her like 63% larger than everything else in her environment, because that was a phenomenon with the toys, is that they had these rinky-dinky little accessories that Barbie didn't quite fit with, but they had them anyway.
I think if we're being honest, they didn't, until Barbie really became a thing, I think they probably were just using standard doll stuff.
Well, Barbie was certainly a thing growing up for me. I didn't have one. I wasn't particularly interested. I kind of ascribed to the traditional gender roles of my era. But I did have a pretty comprehensive collection of She-Ra figures, because she was Masters of the Universe adjacent. They took place in the same universe. But I did have a long list of female-centric dolls with long flowing hair, and they came with accessories like brushes and mirrors and crowns and things. I used them exclusively in relation to the He-Man action figures, but, you know, I had a little something. Now, Barbie was the big femme toy when I was growing up. Go ahead.
A little digression, but wasn't the coding on Prince Adam kind of weird?
I am Adam, Prince of Eternia and defender of the secrets of Castle Grayskull. This is Cringer, my fearless friend. Fabulous secret powers were revealed to me the day I held aloft my magic sword and said, "By the power of Grayskull, I am the power!"
Prince Adam doesn't even wear glasses. He literally is the exact same size as He-Man, looks just like He-Man, and sounds just like... So that means that in the land of Eternia, everybody's like, so there's two 285-pound bodybuilders running around here, and one of them is a vigilante with a secret identity, but it's definitely not this guy that looks exactly like him, but just isn't, you know, doesn't do the voice.
He wears pink. A pink form-fitting vest and a purple woolly trouser. Where He-Man wears a maroon woolly trouser and only has, like, bandoleros.
Who I think we don't recognize enough for being a more skilled and duplicitous figure, normally given credit for, is Cringer, the Prince Adam version of Battle Cat. Because Cringer could talk, and he also never slipped the whole time. He would maybe drop a couple little sly allusions to Adam being He-Man, but he never just slipped and said it. You know, he never, when he was out at the Tiger Bar or whatever.
How many green talking tigers were there in Eternia? I only ever saw the one.
I'm assuming there must be a stable population of them, or there'd be zero. You know, maybe they're endangered, but they seem like they were a known thing. I mean, it is. Otherwise, it'd be very weird for them to just be completely blasé about the one green talk. Because if I saw a green talking tiger today, I would be like, holy shit, where'd you get that? Did you get that from Tippi Hedren or something?
Roar!
Oh, I got it from this guy, He-Man.
He-Man, He-Man.
Who's the big guy with the muscles?
He's He-Man, the most powerful man in the universe. Skeletor is his enemy.
He-Man, He-Man.
If He-Man, Skeletor, and Castle Grayskull, you have to put the castle together.
You're doomed, He-Man.
Oh, yeah? Watch this action, Dad.
He-Man.
Now I have the power.
He-Man and Skeletor each sold separately. Castle Grayskull also sold separately from the Masters of the Universe collection from Mattel.
Well, it is the nature of a man that we have been chosen to talk about, because this is a totally male-centric show. And a totally male-centric movie. But, you know, I was exposed to a lot of Barbie media as a kid. I saw the commercials. Like, there was one where they were going to do a big unveiling of the new edition Barbie. The commercial was just the doll in a big white void, and it had, like, a shroud over it. And you could enter a sweepstakes or something to get a first peek at the Barbie, and I actually...
That was because it was an unannounced Barbie. It wasn't like Morgue Barbie.
Right. 80s children's toy commercials totally worked on me because I had no interest in Barbie, but I wanted to see what the new Barbie looked like because they made such a mystery out of it. Now, I'm sure it was probably Fairy Princess Barbie. I saw one on the shelf, I'm sure. But, like, I remember that commercial and I remember waiting for the day and then I never saw a commercial for the reveal. And so I was always kind of left wondering, I wonder what that Barbie looked like.
Here comes Barbie fun. Barbie Superbet, driving in the sun.
Beauty Secrets Barbie and Sport and Shave Ken dolls each sold separately.
Barbie's taking her driver's test. And Ken's watching.
You can start, steer, and stop the Barbie Superbet by remote control.
She passed the test.
Batteries not included.
Barbie's a super driver.
Barbie Super Vet Car with remote control, Beauty Secrets Barbie, and Sport and Shave Ken dolls each sold separately from Mattel.
Dude, sometimes I think half of the nostalgia that permeates like the late 80s, early 90s childhood media is all continuity related. Because it was, that if you look at some of that stuff, like the other day, I can't remember what I looked at, but it was something where I looked at Silverhawks or something like that, where you look at the Wikipedia and you're like, there were only 12 episodes of that? Then why the fuck could they never air them in order?
Right. Pirates of the Dark Water was the same way.
They were sort of treated so casually by the people that aired them. They took on a grail quality. And of course, like for our embryonic listeners, you couldn't just go buy them or stream them.
No.
You would have to exhaustively tape them off air with a VCR and then put them in order somehow. Sometimes it's very maddening to me. Because, like, I'll find a cartoon that I tried to watch the 48 episodes or something of it, and I'll sit down and just watch it in an afternoon. I'll be like, no, that was okay, I guess. One task crossed off, one task closer to the grave. That came out darker than I thought.
You know what weird rabbit hole I went down the other day? There was a toy line called Dino Riders.
Yeah, of course. That's a normal rabbit hole. Not to be confused with the Dino Saucers.
Dino Saucers was different.
Who were large humanoid dinosaurs.
Right.
Or maybe they were smaller than their actual dinosaur selves, but they were bigger than humans, right?
Used to be four ordinary teenagers. Until one day, we met some new friends from out of town. They were called dinosaurs.
And those were like anthropomorphic dinosaurs with intelligence and speech and machinations.
It was kind of like Thundercats with Chitara, where the pterodactyl one was kind of hot. And you were like, is this furry?
Dino Riders was about actual dinosaurs that get fitted with, like, rocket launchers and machine guns and are used as the tools of a warring clan. One was humans, and one was literally just a melting pot of different sort of anthropomorphic humanoid animals. It was the Mos Eisley Cantina versus the humans, and there was like a time warp or something, and they all got sucked in. They land on primitive Earth, and they decide to conscript the dinosaur natives into their war among the stars, and they fit them with rocket launchers and cool shit.
After years of peaceful existence on the distant planet Valoria, Questar and his people were forced into battle. The power of their step crystal ripped a hole in the fabric of time, sending them backward to prehistoric Earth. Unaware that at the same moment the evil Emperor Krulos was plotting to capture the step crystal with his own grotesque Rulon forces. And so, the battle continues in a new place and time with Dino Riders.
And the video that I clicked on to remind me of all this, like, I was listening and he's going through it and he's going through the development and he's going through, these are how the toys came to be and this is how the TV... The goddamn video on YouTube was like an hour and a half long. I looked down after 15 minutes and said, okay, I was curious about this. I am not invested in this.
Well, and that was definitely one of those ones where it was like Mask or what was the one with the lenticular holograms on them? Subhumanoids or no, that's
no, no, the Inhumanoids were different. You're thinking of Visionaries.
Yeah, yeah. Or what were the ones that were on a zip line? But there was definitely like, and Dino Riders was one of them, where like the driving force there was that the toys were extremely dope.
Mm-hmm.
And like a Dino Riders toy was the dinosaur. And then all the stuff, I'd have to check to see which was the chicken and which was the egg, but it's very reminiscent of like Turok the Dinosaur Hunter. And the Dino Riders themselves had technology and all the technology stuff, metal howdahs and the guns and helmets and stuff that the dinosaurs or the Dino Riders wore. They all came off the dinosaur, and they were very modular and cool and had an appealing number of small fiddly parts. Those were good. Like, and then the quest for the 80s modular toy, speaking of nostalgia enforced through broken continuity, like all those things where you could get, you know, 10 Transformers made a giant Transformer, or like there was a GoBots one. GoBots were kind of the Kmart Transformers.
I had more GoBots than I did Transformers. I'll cop
to
that.
The GoBots giant figure was actually kind of cool because it was a secondary little suit of armor. Any 5 GoBots could wear the arms and legs of the mech.
You can pretend nothing in the universe can stand up to the GoBot power warrior.
He's filled with GoBot power suits.
GoBots sold separately. Power suits are GoBot armor that shield and protect. And when they're combined with the power suit spaceship, they fuse the power of 5 GoBots into one awesome power warrior.
Nothing more powerful.
GoBot Power Warrior. With 4 power suits and spaceship, GoBots sold separately. New from Tonka.
It seemed like it was less buying because the whole thing would work with any GoBots you had. But then, secretly, the little pieces of armor cost as much as a whole new GoBot. So they got you. That's how they get you, in the words of Joe Pesci.
Sky Commanders, by the way, was the name of the zipline toy.
And I think in the 80s they understood, like, and I say 80s, but I do mean 85 through 95. That's the 80s in my world. I think they understood that, like, the problem we're having now with the MCU, like, they understood that you needed something, some kind of tie-in, some kind of continuity. You couldn't just have a toy. You had to have a realm. That's not a bad ramble back toward the lane we're supposed to be in, because that is the genius of Barbie. Barbie is a razor blade business, because the nobody buys Barbie for the plain fleshy Barbie. Once you have a Barbie or one or more Barbies, then you need stuff for them. Because Barbie, she's a little high maintenance. She's got to have that dream house. She's got to have that pink Corvette.
Bringing it all back to Barbie, the movie overall came out to some controversy. I'm almost at the point now, Matt, where I don't want to be that hipster. But when a movie comes out and immediately draws haters, it's almost a guarantee at this point that I'm going to like that movie. What do we got? Harley Quinn is one.
Barbie is another. The Rian Johnson Star Wars.
So this is a thing that interests me. I don't know how much authentic hatred of or backlash against or like, I think everybody really fired from the hip based on the trailer on this one, right?
Well, just based on the property, I think.
Yeah, and like, there's like a whole thing that happens where like everybody was already going on the movie. Like people, I mean, if we're being honest, there's a certain subset of critic that knows what they're going to say before they put it out, you know, and they were already talking about, oh, this is a man-hating movie, you know? And of course, then it becomes as David Cross once put it, like a slam poetry night with rival slam poets, where it's like, I'm reacting to his trailer reaction because of the thing he said last time he was a fuckface about, you know? It all got a little unnecessary, and it's really a manifestation of our current culture's obsession with being first rather than correct, you know? Like, because a lot of it could have been solved if you actually watched the movie a couple times before you watched wrote think pieces about it. And I do have, like, written down, this is one of my core kind of serious questions about this, is does this actually rise to the level of enough satire and commentary? Because it's a very meta movie. It's also an 80s style toy commercial, right? Like it is an unabashed placement for Barbie and a more subtle one for Chevy throughout, right? And so it's like, well, did we get there? Did we insert enough commentary? But that's a legitimate kind of critical concern, right? And that wasn't what the back and forth was about. It was all about the level of feminism. And by feminism, we mean whatever we want to say it means. It was all the shitty guys that make their living that way. There's one in particular I'm not even going to name, but he's made something like in excess of a few hundred videos on Captain Marvel, just on Brie Larson and how she's ruining superhero movies. And it's like, dude, you've done 10 hours of commentary per hour of movie at
this
point.
Why are you so obsessed with me?
Yeah, 220 minute, you know. Well, we know why he's obsessed with her, because she literally does not cape for him and wouldn't give him the time of day. The Captain Marvel movies are kind of strange. I had my complaints with Captain Marvel, mostly of the scope and the feel of it. It's almost like an indoor kung fu movie. It doesn't feel like she's a being on par with Superman for most of it. When the Marvels came out, I also had the thought that I had when Captain Marvel came out, which is this is a movie that is in no sense interested in what men think of the female leads as capital W women. Like there's just nothing sexual about Brie Larson's Captain Marvel character. We don't even really know if she's gay, straight, single, or taken. And there's no real allusion to it in the text. There's not even really a lot of like male gaze in the camera work. It could have been a guy and not affected the story all that much, you know, except it does have a little bit of girl power in it, but not a lot. And the truth is that all those people, it's one of those things where like you interpret the lack of like parody feels like criticism, because all those people that say they want like a gender neutral movie that doesn't touch on the politics of gender, when they got one that actually the character felt gender neutral, didn't have a romance arc, wasn't particularly interested in the men in the movie, they didn't like it. And I kind of had that thought here. That is a component of this movie. There is a lot of gender discourse in this movie, but there's some sort of idealized sort of platonic relationship, capital P platonic, as well as little P platonic most of the time, between the various Barbies and Kens. But it's not super romantic, and the fact that they don't know how to disentangle that is part of the movie.
Since the beginning of time, since the first little girl ever existed, there have been dolls. But the dolls were always and forever baby dolls. Until...
We'll be right back.
Barbie is a movie that starts in a fictive Barbie land, right? That is Barbie, but life-sized, and we meet our main character. She introduces us to her world of Barbies, which is a whole town filled with the different Barbies that have existed over the years. So there's Dr. Barbie and astrophysicist Barbie and President Barbie and Supreme Court Justice Barbie. But our character herself, played by Margot Robbie, and they're not all played by the same woman. You know, they're a very diverse cast of Barbies.
All shapes, you know, and almost, sizes, really.
Yeah, almost performatively so, right?
Like, that was about to be a criticism of mine as I'm sitting here watching the movie going, this is conspicuously more inclusive than the actual Barbie line. But then that comes up. Like, they address it. They talk about it. And they talk about how the ideal isn't necessarily the thing, and then the thing isn't the ideal, and the ideal isn't even really that ideal. Like, this movie surprised me a couple of times when I was ready to kind of cross my arms across my chest and go, come on, guys. Barbie is, like, dripping capitalism.
A lot of them are real Barbies that were at least made briefly or once. They also address the so in the Barbie land, there are a few non-Barbie figures. There's Midges and Skippers, and there are also Allens. Allen is played by Michael Cera, and Allen is a fairly obscure, like, you kind of have to be a Barbie head to know about Allen. I had to look him up on Barbiepedia.
I was definitely on Wikipedia while watching this movie, looking up all, that seems like a nod. Is that an Easter egg? Oh, it is an Easter egg. That's an existing Barbie. Like, Midge came out in the early aughts as the pregnant Barbie, the adult married to Alan pregnant Barbie, but came with some controversy. So they didn't discontinue the doll. They ended up changing its packaging to imply heavily that she was married. But I remember that controversy.
Then they also go to, like, at one point there's kind of a Barbie council of sort of kind of a coven of Barbies that live away from the main community, and they're headed up by the they call her the weird Barbie, but she is a Barbie that has been played with too hard, kind of like she belonged to someone like the bad kid in Toy Story. Then there's a few others that are very unusual, and they're all Barbies that were made very briefly and dropped. Like, there's an 80s Barbie with a TV in her back.
She's a real working video camera. The camera lens is in her necklace. The video screen is on her back.
Who do you video girl?
It's cool to look through Barbie eyes and really see what she sees.
Where do you video girl?
Barbie records video and sound. Then I go to barbie.com/video girl to make it a movie on my PC. Barbie Video Girl is a real working video camera. Batteries not included. Other dolls and vehicles each sold separately.
I have a TV in my back. Whose dream is that? No one's. I can't watch it. It's very well realized. The production design is very interesting. Like, she doesn't have stairs because the prototypical generation of Barbie dream houses did not have stairs. And they're all open fronted, like the dollhouses are open to be so they can be played with, you know. When it's time for her to eat, she goes in the kitchen and she uses life size Barbie accessories that, like, her milk is just a solid block that no milk comes out of, and she eats the imaginary food and it somehow nourishes her because she's in Barbie world, right? When she needs to go downstairs, she either uses the slide on the side of the dream house or just floats down. They take us through, like, your first day of Barbiedom, and she introduces sort of the milieu, and it all culminates. It's in a wonderful party, and it's revealed that they have a dance party almost every night. Then that's where the first crack starts to show, as displayed in the trailer. So it's not a spoiler, but they're doing a special synchronized dance they all prepared with cool choreography. In the middle of it, she's like talking to everybody about how this is the best night ever, just like the night before and tomorrow. And then she goes, "You guys ever think about dying?" And, you know, it's kind of a needle scratch moment. And then the movie starts getting, like, progressively weirder. And it's actually, like, it doesn't swing too hard. Like, it doesn't get Gilliam weird. It's a pretty strangely composed movie. And it always is kind of fantastical. I actually said right before we started that the movie we ought to pair it with for a, you know, if we ever bring back the two movie format would be Poor Things, which also came out this year. Is also nominated for a passel of awards and is also oddly thematically similar, although not super aesthetically similar, except in that they're both very designed and they both take place in very weird worlds, like very surreal kind of, you know, like the Barbie world is almost like an oversaturated vaporwave world. And then the Poor Things is kind of a steampunk world, a little bit reminiscent of the Odd City in Mystery Men. It's a little bit ripped out of time. They're both very odd movies about these sort of cherubic figures coming of age. Obviously, what happens is when there's sufficient dysfunction in Barbie Land, Barbie is sent to the real world to resolve her shit so that she doesn't shatter both dimensions, you know? And while she's in the real world, the Mattel executive, the CEO of Mattel, played by Will Ferrell, reveals that, like, shit's going to get weirder the longer she's in reality, and they have to get her contained. And that's the A plot, you know, is that she has things to do in reality before she can go back and be a content Barbie again. And the Mattel is trying to round her up and suppress the fact that there are life-size Barbies in a place somewhere implied to be roughly the middle of Arizona.
So this was directed by Greta Gerwig, who folks may know from her Oscar-nominated directing turns in Lady Bird and Little Women, and was co-written with her frequent collaborator, and I believe they are a couple now, or maybe they were, or are, I don't know. I don't keep up with the Mumblecore gang. But she is working in this case with Noah Baumbach, who in and of himself is an Oscar-nominated writer, who put together Marriage Story. He was the writer-director on that.
And yeah, I didn't watch that. That looked dumb. That looked like a...
I thought you did watch it. I thought you boring. Watched it for our Oscar episode.
Nope.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what. For a movie that makes you feel so awkward and out of place about a couple fighting and getting a divorce, it was really well done. Laura Dern is a delight.
I live in an apartment building, Trevor. I can hear realistic couple fights anytime I want.
There you go. Yeah. You're
just have to turn off my ANC, and that's my world. So
you've got the experience. I can say that. Like, watching that movie is to experience that hot feeling on the back of your neck when you know you're in trouble at your friend's house. And you don't know how things work there. You don't know how discipline works in this house, but you know the parents are angry and you are there and cannot get away. That is Marriage Story. But the thing that I think is really incredible about Barbie being directed by Greta Gerwig, if you look at Lady Bird and you look at Little Women and you look at Barbie, we are talking about three very different films. Lady Bird is a contemporary coming-of-age story about the relationship between a girl and her mom and the kind of weird, contentious way they can rub up against each other, but they still love each other. It's a beautiful movie. I love it. Little Women, obviously an adaptation of the Louisa May Alcott novel, weaving in a little bit of her life autobiographically. It is also a coming-of-age story about women, but it is a period piece. It is fancy men and fancy women and betrothed people and a comedy drama of manners. I loved it. It was great. And then you've got Barbie, which is this super stylized, hyper-nostalgic, very in its license, very in its franchise, totally turned on its ear and weaponized against the thing that it used to be. And they're just, they look different. They sound different. They're paced differently. And so it's really interesting to watch Greta Gerwig's kind of arc here. Going from her world, she was an actress before she was a director. She was the darling of Mumblecore, which is a small subset of indie film. I remember in 2007 when she was at South by Southwest, she was the cover girl for the Austin Chronicle that year, talking about the queen of Mumblecore. And now she's this Oscar-nominated working director, and she's made three almost aggressively different films that have some Venn overlap. They're all coming-of-age stories in one way or another. Many of them deal with the relationship between a daughter and a mother in one way or another. But they are so almost aggressively different. And I can't help but admire that.
Yeah. And then there's this. you can't call it a non-commercial movie, right? Like, it's certainly not indie. It's certainly not mumblecore. And you're just like, what is going on here? So the whole time you watch it, you're like, so this is subversive, but it's not. They're subverting a lot of stereotypes about Barbie, but they're doing it by saying, oh no, Barbie has always been like this. Like, Barbie had a, you know, everybody thinks Barbie was a housewife until 1996, but actually, like, Barbies with Jobs came out in the 60s, you know? They're attacking the stereotype, but they're sort of doing it by carrying the company line. Right about the time that you've recrossed your arms, right? Then she gets to the real world, and that is openly stuck on a pole again when she gets to the boardroom, and the whole board of the Barbie company is male, you know? Will Ferrell is very performatively like, get me some guys in here that know how to defend women, you know? Like, and now I've watched it twice. It feels very, it's still weird. It's no Eraserhead, but I am going to think about the movie when I see the Barbie logo in the future, you know?
Where I landed on this, the second the credits started rolling, I liked that. I wanted to like it more. But I also think it's a movie that I will grow to appreciate the more I watch it. Because there are definitely points in here where I'm like, oh, I see what they're doing. I see the thing, I see the allegory, I see the representation of our times, I see the issue that they're trying to raise. Right about the time that I think Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach, when they were writing the script, wanted me to catch on to those things. But in retrospect, reflecting on it, I'm like, oh, those were also foreshadowed. Those things, there were little bits and pieces here. So I think this is a movie that is going to reward rewatch, because you will pick up on more earlier once you see where it's going. Because you're right, Matt, this is weird.
Babysitter Skipper, three times more to do with three little babies.
Basically, Barbie lives in Barbie Land. Things are weird. She's starting to have ideations about death and dark things, things that are abhorrent to the Barbie world. She's going to the real world with her Ken pair to try and find the girl that is playing with her to improve her mood, so then Barbie can go back to normal and go back to Barbie Land and live this Barbie lifestyle. And so we're treated to a little bit of Barbie Land. We're treated to a little bit of what it is to be a Ken and what he does. And then we are treated to this fish out of water story where they are in the real world, quote unquote. And the real world here is, I hesitate to say that it's a funhouse mirror version of the real world, but it's definitely operating on some comedy physics here. But it is where Barbie Land is hyper-satire, the real world is a little more moderate satire, but definitely still satire. And then we have to take a few people from the real world and bring them back to Barbie World, and then Barbie World is all fucked up Back to the Future 2 style, and we have to set things right. At the end of the day, I never felt like this quite got up to highway speed. I think there was a lot of allegory here and the story missed out a little bit, but I also do not know how to realistically make that criticism of a movie about a toy that literally had no real canon, no real backstory, no, like, of all the Barbie cartoons that are out there, none of them take place in the same universe. They're not like Marvel. They're not managed. It's just like, let's get a thing, let's slap Nutcracker. Okay, we'll do the Barbie Nutcracker. Barbie is the main dancer. Oh, we're going to do Cinderella now. Barbie is Cinderella, and we'll tell the story of Cinderella.
And I'm with you because, like, this is probably the most mature and wry Barbie movie that you could make without devolving wholly into attacking the property, right? And this is so glowing in points that it feels like they're digressing into a little short, you know, mini doc about, you know, like Ruth Handler or, you know, a couple of the other founding figures at Barbie. They really almost kind of gloss them and shine them up in this in a couple places. So, like, on the one hand, you leave it going like, that is probably the best movie that you could make about Barbie that had any kind of serious treatment or subtext to it, right? On the other hand, you know, the Avatar walking back to the car effect kicks in and you're like, but what does that mean? You know, that's like being the best badminton player in the Vatican, you know. I liked it quite a bit, and I appreciated the core subversion, which is that, like, sort of vis-a-vis the politics of the outside world, the Kens are the women. It is very explicitly stated that Ken is the second product, and that Ken exists in the... He was... they even kind of allude to the Bible and say that Ken was expressly created to complement and help Barbie. At one point when the Ken, the Ryan Gosling Ken, is wrestling with that, he says, like, I don't exist outside of your gaze, which is a very weird, darkly poetic thing to have in a movie like this, right? Like, that's a, you know, I suppose you could think of it romantically, but in the context, it's kind of dark and stocky, you know? So it's like a very strange meditation on is it proper to regard one gender as complementary or topping for the other one? But the subversion, the attempt to kind of lower status and defang the humor is to have it be the men, right? Which is kind of what the Well Actually guys didn't like. And, you know, fuck them. It's the best way to do it, clearly. And so, like, I thought more worked than didn't. I had a pretty good time watching it. I had a pretty good time with the... I even found Will Ferrell tolerable, which I usually... he's kind of a short dose person, him and Molly Shannon, most of his Saturday Night Live class. Unless he does something dramatic, which he's really good in.
Here's what I'll say about Will Ferrell. You're right. For me, he is also a small doses actor that works better the less you use him. He works here, nearly reprising his role from the Lego Movie.
I mean, it's honestly not even that different from his role in Elf in a way, because he's obviously like... Like, it's very clear that the fictional Mattel company in the movie knows something is weird about reality and knows that there's this weird toy dimension. And some of the parts that are set in the Mattel building almost reminded me of something of a bigger swing, like Robin Williams' toy or something, where they got real weird, you know, because the internal physics of the Mattel building don't make a lot of sense, and it's got weird rooms, like what Willy Wonka style, like, why would you build this rooms, you know? And that is, and everything about this is deliberate. This is a very constructed, you know, designed movie. There's no accidents in it. It's quite interesting, and it sort of pairs, what was the one that came out where the kind of Stepford Wives thing where they all lived in the desert, the Florence Pugh one? But it reminded me of which I haven't seen, but it reminded me of it visually for some reason, you know, in kind of the American brain, like the desert is retirement land. And I thought that was like an interesting echo from thing to thing there. I really enjoyed some of the supporting people like Simu Liu of the Shang-Chi movie. He was sort of the rival Ken, although they're rivals for nothing. Like none of them are going to win. It is made very clear, like, They don't even have genitals. There's nothing for them to do, you know, but, which it's funny because Weird Barbie as kind of the, you know, sort of the stand in for like an older woman, she's kind of more sexual. And at one point Ryan Gosling walks by and she goes, oh, I'd like to get a lump at, I'd like to get a peek at his, shapeless nude mound. Like there's actually a lot of good, like, one-liner value here. Remember Proust Barbie? That didn't work out well.
Well, and we haven't even said the name America Ferrera yet, who is the real world person that Barbie must connect with. It's her and the actress playing her daughter. They're Barbie's home team that decide that they're gonna scrum up and help Barbie accomplish her mission.
The deeper connection to the franchise being that her character is a former Barbie diehard that works for the company, wants to be like a designer, and has fallen into the role of Will Ferrell's administrative assistant kind of by default. You know, she's kind of not being let work inside her actual job description and told to make the coffee and such, you know, because they can't, if no one brings them their coffee, they can't keep helping women at the necessary pace, you know? The sort of modernized mother-daughter relationship then leads to some real hijinks when Barbie gets into the real world and has to confront, like, California teenagers, and that stuff's pretty good. How can She called me a fascist. I don't control the factories or the railroads.
At least now everybody knows the actual dictionary definition of fascist, because that is something that Weekend One made the memosphere.
Well, yeah, and I think that's some of the most working content here is that snappy dialogue. And there's quite a lot of it here, and it sort of hits you because the movie is so disarming.
Well, and it's interesting, again, just talking about kind of the range of work here. Noah Baumbach and Greta Gerwig are you know, they cut their teeth on mumblecore, which is heavily improvised, very naturalistic sounding dialogue. And then you have this, which is absolutely artificial. I don't know what the actual production was, but I can't imagine that there was a lot that was improvised or that was natural. Like, it is all very presentational, and in weaker hands, I think, would have come off as a bad performance. But because we do a good job of establishing this world, establishing these rules, and just establishing the overall tone of the movie, we're able to get away with this really clunky, phony, plastic, for lack of a better word, dialogue. But it also all very much works. It's very funny. It plays
it's
by its own rules.
It's tone on the surface of plot, yeah. Though. Yeah, it's tone on the surface of plot, because they successfully convince you that that is how Barbie would talk.
It is weird, and we were talking about this a little off mic. A director can be so bald with what they're trying to convey, and people still miss it. We were talking about The Wolf of Wall Street, Martin Scorsese. There is no way I can parse that film where I look at it and say, yeah, Jordan Belfort is an aspirational character. Martin Scorsese is telling us to look at this guy and say, this is how to be. This is a guy so cool and so successful. If you do all of this, you're going to be just like him. It's not. It's the exact opposite of that. Which is to say, in both real life and the movie, he does not end well. He certainly doesn't end the story where he was at its apex. And people miss that. They miss that Jordan Belfort is not an aspirational character. They just see, oh, this guy's got a lot of naked women with him. He's got a lot of blow. He's got a lot of money. He's got a nice car. And he's hilarious when he does quaaludes. I want to be that guy. And completely miss the third act where it's like, no, man, this guy is kind of a giant piece of garbage. He has Margot Robbie and loses her. And I'm shrugging my shoulders, which I can't really convey over mic. But that said, we're about at our spoiler curtain. So let's put a pin in the rest of our thoughts. We'll talk about it after the spoiler curtain, where we can get digressive with plot details. But final thoughts before the curtain. Matt, what do you think about Barbie?
I liked this a lot. I thought it was a hoot. Everything in it's pretty good. A few little problems with it, but they're sort of on the level of the stuff we were just kind of speaking to. I don't have any real question. Like I don't know how to put it. Like, it made its point, and now I've gotten the point. You know, I think it succeeded, but I also I don't know if I was the audience.
I will say that this was definitely a movie that was for certain people, and I don't think it was for me. I didn't have a lot of Barbie knowledge. I missed a lot of the Easter eggs without looking them up on Wikipedia. I'm not a femme-presenting person. And I think there is a lot... Maybe I'm projecting. I don't know. I could be totally off-base. But I think there is a lot of femme and female perspective present in this story. And that I think the catering to that nostalgia, the representation of those feelings, I think that's all very enriching for a certain audience. I don't think I was that audience. That is not a criticism, however.
I really liked the surprising number of the Will Ferrell lines. Like, as the nephew of a female aunt.
And see, I don't think that line would have worked in any other movie. That is a cheesy-ass line. That is a line that, in the hands of, dare I say, a different actor, would not have played as well. I will say that the exact amount of Will Ferrell in this is the exact amount that it needed. But from a character standpoint, I also don't know why he's there. His character doesn't really do anything other than provide kind of an antagonistic force that we ultimately don't need. That said, he didn't bother me, so I didn't mind him. He had some good lines, it was kind of funny. He was really the weird anchor that would bring it back to comedy when things were getting a little too serious. And that's not normally a thing I appreciate from Will Ferrell, but I did appreciate it here. Like I said, I'm not the audience for this. That is not a criticism, because it still was enjoyable for me as a person who is not the dead center target audience. I still had a good time. I loved the song and dance numbers. I loved the performances. Ryan Gosling was fantastic. Margot Robbie was fantastic. I loved picking out the little different cameos. We had, that might be a spoiler, so I won't. We'll just say there's some cameos. And I could tell that Greta Gerwig, as a director, was having fun by including things like Alan, the super obscure friend of Ken, and Midge, who is canonically Alan's wife, eventually, who was also a discontinued Barbie line. And the President Barbie looks like the President Barbie that was released back in the 80s. Like, it's a whole thing. You could probably, and there probably exists several web pages that are like the best call-outs to Barbie. I missed all of those, but I still had a fantastic time. And even though this movie never felt like it got up to highway speed with me, I have the feeling that criticism for me is going to change on rewatch. I think this is a movie that's going to invite rewatch. I think it's going to reward rewatch. And I will say it, I am going to see this movie several more times before I ever watch Love Story or Marriage Story again. And it covers some of the same ground. And so I think this is it's a directing triumph. Most of the effects in this, by the way, Matt, practical. Most of the set pieces and the props and the actual physical sets, they're all real. And there is I think that's to be rewarded, because there is a definite skill and deftness here to making everything look so fake and cheesy. And I'd almost dock them points for it by saying it just looks fake and cheesy, except when they go into the real world, they show you that, no, we know how a movie is made, we know how it's supposed to look, but Barbie's world is different. It's a whole lot of fake cheesy shit, and so we're going to do it fake and cheesy, but when it's time to get serious, we can get serious. And that just, it came off beautifully for me. And so this was interesting to watch, it was funny, the writing was somehow both very obvious and very clever. And America Ferrera was fantastic. The girl who plays her daughter was fantastic. Margot Robbie is fantastic. I love me a baby goose. And so, yeah, this is a definite recommend for me. All right, Matt. Well, if you will reach your little paddle hand out on your non-articulated arm and hit the giant red plastic button, I think we can drop that spoiler curtain.
What is that? Are you accusing me of being so... Oh, it's a doll thing. Okay. I thought you were accusing me of being a penguin. all right. I bonk it with my flipper.
Tickle-lee. Together we can be happy family. Beat Mitch, Alan, Brian, two baby makes four. Happy family with room for one more. Dr. Barbie on call. It's a girl. Changing table, a cradle and a doll. Little one needs lots of care. Let's take a stroll.
Happy Family sets, each sold separately.
What? This is a real rager, Barbie.
Thanks, Barbie. Gosh, this night is just perfect.
It's perfectly perfect.
And you look so beautiful, Barbie.
Thanks, Barbie. I feel so beautiful.
So do I.
This is the best day ever.
It is the best day ever, and so is yesterday, and so is tomorrow, and so is the day after tomorrow, and even Wednesdays, and every day from now until forever. No! Do you guys ever think about dying?
I don't know why I just said that.
I'm just dying to dance.
All right, guys, so I'm going to level with you. Ken is you when you are at your rock bottom after the breakup, and the movie is very politely asking you to knock that shit off. And honestly, that's what I think a lot of men left pissed about, because they recognized themselves in the reprehensible behavior of Ken. And a movie that was calling that behavior out as toxic and improper. And they said, fuck you. My heart is broken. She was my everything. You don't know what you're talking about. This whole movie blows. And that is, again, the toxic behavior that they're talking about and calling out.
I think some of the critical reaction to the movie from the people who felt criticized would have been gentler if the movie had not been so gentle with Ken, because she's ultimately almost maternal toward him, because they're never really together.
No, she never likes him. She never falls out of love with him. She was never in love with him to begin with, which I think is an important but subtle nuance here.
Well, and they're sort of like crowded together by the rules of their society. Like she is, he is her Ken, so to speak, right? It's also by the rules of their society, because they are a toy for kids. They're anatomically incorrect for most of the movie, right? It's a strange commentary on like possessiveness and assumptions. And that relationship, which is kind of the core of the movie, almost overshadowing the intended core of the movie, which is the relationship with the women that own the literal Barbie doll, right?
Right.
And are playing with her and making her mind weird. There's a lot of good fun and games when the Kens like try to seize their power, but they're almost a little too dumb to, like the Ryan Gosling line about, I learned about something called the patriarchy, which is apparently where like society is run by men and horses. And then later he's like, I was wrong about patriarchy. I thought it was a society run by men and horses, but actually the horse is just kind of a man extender. And he brings all of that off like so sincerely and straight-facedly. Like, I liked all of that. I also like some of the stuff where they kind of get into like the first party they have after she starts to have dark thoughts, and like Ken is still hanging around, and he's like, I thought I could spend the night. And she's like, for what? I don't want you here. Like, you can't look back at the movie and say that she really led him on or anything like that. They strip that out of the text very successfully.
No, absolutely. She is not interested from the word go.
This is what I think is actually kind of interesting about him is he isn't really interested in doing anything specific with her. He's just possessive. Like, he just thinks their relationship should go to some unspecified next place, and that there should be more exclusivity to it. He's jealous of nothing. And of course the actors are a little older, because the Barbies are supposed to be mature. But if you see this in the context of a, you know, people between 15 and 25, that's how them boys are. If they really got in a serious relationship, all of a sudden they'd be the dog that caught the car, you know. All of that I thought worked very well. My problem with the movie structurally is they wanted to do the fish out of water stuff so bad. And also, I think, avoid just having it be a really wacky movie that the whole thing is in this other world. So they came up with this plot that happens in the real world to give them something to do, so that her scenes with the family in the real world would not just be going and talking to them, going and meeting the people at the Mattel building and that kind of thing. And that plot is not super clear. Like, they kind of, the Mattel people want to get Barbie, box her back up in her life-size box, and send her back to Barbie land with her brain scrubbed or something. And to do that, they have to get in a car chase. And that is the problem, is that the outline of that third of the movie is not great. It gets by on charisma, and it all mostly still works. But that is the weaker, you know, segment of the movie to me, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Some of this... Some of the stuff in the real world works really good, like the part where Barbie is figuring out that she's in the real world now and figuring out, like, basically she's having that child to adult moment where she realizes, like, other people exist. There's this very moving moment with a, you know, she's in the park and she's watching, like, oh, here's this other couple and they're doing coupley things. And here's this, you know, here's these people that are fighting and here's these little kids and here, and then there's an older woman on a bench with her and they kind of share a moment. That stuff works really well. The chase stuff where we don't quite know if we're in the wacky Barbie physics or the real world seems like inside the Mattel building, the rules are more like they are in Barbie land, but not 100%. Some of that stuff is a little shakier, but I liked it mostly.
See, I have, and this is, keep in mind, I've read very little about behind the scenes making of, and I would be very interested to read in 15, 20 years, the oral history of the making of Barbie. Because I have a theory that Mattel, as an entity, and Mr. Mattel, as a character specifically, as played by Will Ferrell, I think they were intended to be much more sinister. And probably for licensing reasons, they didn't let Greta Gerwig get away with that. Now, I am surprised to the level at which she was allowed to level some criticism at Mattel. But it just... really, Will Ferrell has nothing to do. Like, I don't want to say we need more Will Ferrell in this movie, because we absolutely do not. But that character is not consequential at all.
It's kind of strange, because, like, on the one hand, I'm absolutely sure you're correct, and there was a much drier, much meaner version of this movie at one point. Also, though, I don't know if it actually hurts the movie that that's not what they made. If they had made something that more clearly indicted the property directly, it wouldn't have been as interesting. Because they do tread the ground of, like, there's scientist Barbie, but she's just a hot Barbie in a lab coat. Then there's all this setup that Barbie can do anything, and then the women that play with Barbie grow up and still live in the real world. They work that in, but they do it in a way that, like, and I think it's probably to the movie's credit that at the end of the day, it does come off like somebody involved in the production actually liked Barbies. Because I think if they just gave them the property to tear it up and throw pot shots at it, that's what you get. Like, that's the Mindy Kaling Velma, right? It's satire without a loving core. And it does come across as like, oh, I wanted to make a show and they gave me the... you know, I was given this existing license to kind of pad out my Family Guy type show I wanted to make, right? Then it would feel more like something that, you know, Uwe Boll got a hold of, where he didn't really care about the license. And that is a certain kind of death of any kind of, like kind of like we talked about in Galaxy Quest. Galaxy Quest would not have worked if the people that made it didn't like Star Trek. So I think they could have gone more bitterer and accidentally, like, cut off their nose to spite their face if they did. But I do agree that specifically Mattel, that the note I wrote down is this real, or is this the Wendy's Twitter? Which the Wendy's Twitter is very funny viral marketing, but it's also obviously operated by Wendy's, you know? And I do think that, like, they stressed out whoever's job it was to play along. And they were like, no, could you maybe not make us quite that evil? We are letting you use the license, right? And I think you're right. There was probably an intention that they be a more clear-cut actual villain. They touched on that at one point when the Kens are about to take over, and the Ken dolls start outselling the Barbies, and the Ken's bachelor pad, which is called the Mojo Dojo Casa House, which is the Barbie dream house, but it's repainted and draped in man stuff, and it has a pinball machine and you know, like a beer keg. And when all that stuff starts flying off the shelves, a Mattel flunky says, well, they're actually selling well, because the Mattel CEO, the whole reason they want to capture Barbie and put her back in Barbie world is so that this weird reality alteration where the toy world and the real world reflect each other stops happening and goes back to normal. A flunky executive says to Will Ferrell, like, well, why do we care? Because the Ken stuff's selling more than the Barbie stuff. Like, it's a hit. Why do we care? The executive has a moment of sincerity where he's like, we can't do this to the universe. It's not fair to the little girls, and it's not fair to the history of Barbie. And so he comes across like he actually does care about their legacy. And I do think it probably would have been a little clearer and stronger. The thing to do would have been to reverse it and try to keep her from fixing herself and going back.
Well, and, you know, there's the other arm of that where Mattel 4 years, okay, you know, we'll just put it out in the open. Barbie as a brand faces a lot of criticism, especially from people who are fighting for women's rights, who are fighting for representation. It's like the prototypical Barbie, of which they brand Margot Robbie. They say she is the prototypical Barbie.
She even says at one point, well, I'm the Barbie, like I'm stereotypical Barbie. I'm the one you think of when you think of a Barbie. And that comes in the course of like, she's defending Barbiedom and being like, well, yeah, there's Barbie scientists and Barbie doctors and my, you know, the mayor of our town is a Barbie and the president of our country is a Barbie. And then the I think it's the daughter that she's speaking to says, well, do you do any of those things? She's like, well, no, I'm stereotypical Barbie.
Right, the stereotypical Barbie who is hot and doesn't do anything.
Yeah, like I'm the main Barbie, you know?
And that's the thing, is no matter for how many times Mattel put Barbie in space, put her in the White House, put her in a lab or whatever, for every scientist, doctor, lawyer, judge, president Barbie, it's always Barbie, but she's the president. Barbie, but she's a teacher. Barbie, but she's an astronaut. And Barbie as a brand is still a blonde, unrealistically physically person who doesn't, like, they are intentionally a blank slate for children to project things onto. But that also just basically became Barbie is a stereotypical woman, girl, teenager, what have you.
I think the movie does the brand the favor of pointing out that they do have all this variety of Barbies and that they have for a long time, even longer than most people think, right? Because most people think that Barbie sort of followed into the workforce later than she really did, because like the first Barbies with jobs came out in the literally in the late 50s or 60s. Like, it didn't take too long after Barbie for there to be a Barbie with a job, right? But... And I think the first couple were like, weren't they like Nurse Barbie and something like that, Business Barbie? They were kind of very broad. But then the movie, having done Mattel a favor, does hang a lampshade on the fact that like, well, all these other Barbies exist, but this movie's about Barbie. You know, so it does this throughout. It kind of gives with one hand and then takes away. The nostalgia around the brand comes off pretty well. But by the time the credits roll, it's hard to say how the movie feels about, like, Mattel. I don't know if that's unintended ambiguousness or if that's, like, kind of the point, right? Which is that you it is a blank slate toy. It's up to you to play with it and make it something, right? But the fact that we've talked about it for longer than its runtime and we have actual philosophical questions about it means that it exceeded all expectations I had when I heard a Barbie movie was greenlit.
Oh, looks like this beach was a little too much beach for you, Ken.
If I wasn't severely injured, I would beat you off right now, Ken.
I'll beach off with you any day, Ken.
Hold my ice cream, Ken. All right, Ken, you're on. Let's beach off.
Anyone who wants to beach him off has to beach me off first.
I will beach both of you off at the same time.
But you don't even know how to beach yourself off. How are you going to beach both of us off? It doesn't make sense.
Ken? And why are you beach yourself off?
You're going to beach both of us off?
Nobody's going to beach anyone off.
Advertising doesn't work on me. I'm woke to the machine. I know what they're trying to do to me. They're trying to harvest my data. They're trying to do this. They're trying to get me to buy things. The algorithm is servicing me this, and I wanted this, and isn't it all bullshit? But at the same time, it all circles back to what I said at the beginning.
Oh, advertising works on me. Advertising works on me. If I physically fit in a Nissan GTR, I'd hawk my ass to buy one.
Back in the day, just as a child watching TV who had no interest in Barbie whatsoever, I still wanted to see the mysterious Barbie under the shroud. It still worked on me. So no matter who you are and who you became as an adult, whether it be Matt Foster, Trevor Trujillo, or Greta Gerwig, you can still be a feminist. You can still fight for equal rights for women, for equal pay, for equal representation in the workplace and in media. You can fight for all of these things and still have a history of playing with Barbies.
When you put it like that, we should have both taken the Greta Gerwig option.
What is
then
that?
Then we'd be very successful triplets.
But yeah, there are pro-feminist, pro-women, pro-inclusion, pro-LGBTQ, like the people who are on the right side of history that still played with Barbies, even though Barbie was selling us a world that didn't exist.
They do make the interesting point that Barbie represented a wave of toys that was the first that were in their time relatively progressive, because they were not even the very first swimsuit model Barbie, who was kind of modeled off like she's kind of like a Betty Page type pinup figure. They point out that she is, for the time, you know, the late 50s, she was somewhat progressive because she, at the very least, was not a child or a mom, which were the main two things that dolls were of. So when Barbie was introduced, a simple, you know, quote-unquote action figure of just an adult woman with a life of some sort was a bit novel and was a little bit edgy at the time.
Right.
And they get into like, well, is this something that was never intended to be progressive, or is it something that you know, it like the classical pattern of capitalism, it was aggressive when it was new, and then it developed its own culture and stultified a bit, right?
Well, I think we get right into that, because Rhea Perlman, why she's not in the contention for a Best Supporting Actress nomination for this movie, she did a fantastic job. She is this kind of matronly figure that she ultimately plays the woman who invented Barbie historically. Kind of a Hollywood representation of who that would be. Ruth Handler, I think, was her name.
I would like to point out, Ken and Barbie were her two kids, which, like, a weird choice was made there. Maybe make Barbie marry Alan and have your son be your daughter's husband's friend. I don't know how much thought was put into that.
Well, and, you know, I don't know what the historicity of Barbie is. I really don't. I know there are documentaries. I know there are stories out there. I have just never sought them out. But what I am taking away from this on exactly one viewing is that Rhea Perlman was the creative force. She was the idea person. Not Rhea Perlman, but the character she's playing, Ruth Handler, who is a historical figure. She is the idea person, but then it was taken away from her. It was given to Mattel, which is run by men. And so despite what she was as this what Barbie was as this groundbreaking toy that sought to break down barriers and shatter stereotypes, got control of by this boardroom full of men and shoehorned into traditionally female roles until traditionally female roles were no longer commercial. And then they started playing to another commercial angle where now Barbie can be anything. She can be an astronaut. She can be a mermaid. She can be the president. I love President Barbie in this, by the way. Like, some of the best lines in the movie come out of her. And I think that... And so the ultimate thing that kind of turns the story around is this very motherly, very matronly moment between Ruth Handler and Barbie saying, I don't want to be a Barbie anymore. I don't know that this is for me. And she says, you don't need my permission. Go be who you are and who you want to be and find yourself.
Well, that scene where they're discussing that and the fact that, like, and because one thing I have written down that I wrote down during the bench scene, part of this movie is about the question, like, is it, like, it's a Peter Pan conceit. Is growing up worth it, right? Is autonomy worth awareness of mortality and responsibility and you know, et cetera, et cetera. And the movie kind of comes down, A, in the yes column, and then also B, it kind of makes the point, like, no one tells you when the oven timer's up. No one ever sits you down and says you're an adult. No one ever sits you down and tells you, you know, you can just ignore people that suck, right? You're not actually beholden to all this stuff. You can violate your social roles. That was a very interesting moment of thesis, and I liked that a lot and thought that that part worked extremely well. And it's a question of how productive would it have been? Would it have been worth the extra points of satire to risk the relationship with Mattel, right? And Rhea Perlman actually does make one little sly joke about having tax problems or something.
Which happened to the real Ruth Handler.
The
double mastectomy and the this movie weaves reality and fiction very well.
Well, and I'm not gonna say that she was like mom in Futurama or anything, but she was like a wealthy, powerful woman who was not purely a matronly cookie cooking figure, you know.
She was not the old lady from The Matrix.
Well, I'm sure she was 2 days a week at home, you know. But
to say nothing of the Simpsons episode where Lisa meets the creator of the Barbie analog in that world.
Don't be fooled. She's just a regular Malibu Stacy with a stupid cheap hat. She still embodies all the awful stereotypes she did before.
But she's got a new hat.
I think it was Lauren Bacall did the voice. And she's kind of a hard, tough woman who got butted out at one point and is eager to make her comeback and gets supplanted by a hat. I honestly just brought that up so I could pull the clip. But I think it's germane.
Well, and like, I think it makes kind of a good argument against some of the criticisms of Barbie by kind of like pointing out that, like, well, this is a plaything and it's your response. You're responsible for the things you project, right? And you can drop them as you grow up. That's a little bit what the movie is about. And then obviously, of course, the cure for the Ken reality wave is that, you know, setting them down and talking about some of the contradictory annoyances of being a woman in the world, right? Having to be thin, but not skinny, and need to have money and be in shape, but never admit that either of those things takes effort. And they get into some of those dichotomies, and that's what snaps everybody out of it. And when she gives a moving speech to the Barbies, you know, that stuff is, I think it still functioned, but, you know, it operates in threes as they take each Barbie and deprogram them, you know, in semi-private. And I thought they went through it enough times. I could have personally dealt with 1 to 2 less times.
Well, again, I think that's we're running into the problem that content is not necessarily for us. Now, I'm not trying to claim myself as woke or morally superior or anything like that, but there is an awareness in this movie that knew that the criticism from the male-dominated right was coming.
I mean, that explicit moment is in the movie. Like, when Barbie and Ken are finally communicating and finally have talked through some of this stuff and come to sort of an agreement about how, you know, the Barbie world will be, right as they are really coming to an agreement, he goes in for a kiss and she has to actually stop him and go, he goes, hey, I know we were getting along better, but that was not an invitation for that, right? And they have to, and then that's when he launches into this, like, I don't even know what I want kind of thing, you know. And I don't know that it's a question of if it's not for me. Several things in this are hit hard enough that I got them the first time, and then they're in there a couple more times. The one that really did get me is the line where Ken turns around and says, well, in this world, it's like the Kens are the Barbies and the Barbies are the Kens. Like that really had a Ben Garrison political cartoon labeling feel to it. There's a couple moments in that where they really do repeat something, like, and kind of get it, you know. That knocked a couple percentage points off the movie for me, but not to the point of a negative review or anything, you know.
Between the audience that got that on the first time and the audience that didn't, we're probably in the first one. Again, not morally superior, not trying to make ourselves anything that we're not. That argument, that conversation, that thing that a real woman has to have that conversation with a clingy guy, they do have to have it 5 or 6 times to make sure that it gets nailed home, because people don't get it on the first time. A lot of people will have that awareness, but there are people who miss that awareness who do need to be told 5 or 6 times. Now, does that make an excuse for the movie to do it 5 or 6 times? I don't know. But I think that was the intent.
Well, my thought, who is the third time for? Like, the first time is for the people that already know. The second time is for people that missed the first time because they had their hand in their popcorn or whatever, right? I don't know that the people that willfully missed it twice and get it thrice are a huge group of people. I think by the time this movie was done, I don't think that there was anybody that they wore down through repetition of the theme, right?
No, I agree. But I also think to a certain degree that content is there repetitively, not necessarily to preach to an audience, but to show solidarity with the audience for people who have had to do that 5 or 6 times. I don't know. I could be totally off base.
They're definitely talking about how abrasive all of it is, right? A couple of them were so sharp that they didn't feel like they didn't feel consistent with the rest of the script, and they felt focus groupy. Some meddler said, it's not explicit enough, turn it up a little. They're different from the ones that are more of the natural ebb and flow. Like, there's 2 or 3 specific lines I'm thinking of where they really looked out at the audience and said the shit, you know? That was dangerous, and it does show that movie making is a combination of cast, writer, and director, because different people could have said the same words worse and it could have broken the movie like a bubble. There were a couple times when like I had the thought, like, I'm glad they got people that could carry some of this. And some of it was even some of the comedy stuff, like the dance-offs with the Kens and the kind of 300 parody with the Kens. That stuff had to be fully sent, or it would have been ridiculous, you know? Well, I mean, it is ridiculous, but it would have been inauthentic. And it works totally. Like, every one of them seems like they're really, like, they're very committed comedy bits, you know?
I'm just kidding. Anywhere else I'd be a 10. Is it my destiny to live and die a life of blonde fragility? I'm just kidding. Where I see love, she sees a friend. What will it take for her to see the man behind the tent and fight for me? I'm just kidding.
And I'm enough.
And I'm great at doing stuff.
So hey, check me out. Yeah, I'm just kidding.
Some of the unsung Kens were really good, like the kind of the stern, deep-voiced guy, and of course the John Cena Mermaid Ken cameo.
Speaking of cameos, Emerald Fennell as Midge, the pregnant Barbie, Oscar-nominated writer, I think she's a writer, definitely director, but she's the one who made Promising Young Woman, and Saltburn, for that matter, which was, I don't know that actually made any nominations this year, but it was definitely in the hunt. But yeah, I
don't know. I keep watching the first 10 minutes of Saltburn and getting so disgusted with the cast that I turn it off, which I think it means it's working, but I need to tough it out and get to the plot part. The other thing that I had noted down is that the woman on the bench that she has the moment with is the costumer for the movie.
God, I loved that.
Or, well, rather, she's a costume designer. I don't know.
I love that moment. And it's because it was another moment in this movie, which of which there are many, that subverted my expectations. Because there is a moment between, it's just between Margot Robbie's Barbie and an elderly lady sitting on a public bench. And Barbie's kind of admiring her and looking at her and kind of seeing an old person for the first time. And she looks at her and she says, "You are so beautiful." Which, in the glurgy, Hallmark, precious moments figure, gooey caramel center of my heart that I try not to acknowledge exists, got me. Her response was totally unexpected, because you expect her to kind of blush and shrug it off and say, oh, I'm an old lady. Or she just looks at her and says, I know. And I loved it even more. It's like, here is this woman empowering another person, and then the other person's like, right on, sister, hell yeah, I'm good looking. And that was such a wonderful, not typical moment, not a prayer at the beginning of the Super Bowl on a commercial playing to a racial and class stereotypes moment. It was like, oh, wow, that totally went a different direction than I did. And it's such a short, like, four-line exchange.
That was actually one of the lines that I was talking about, because, like, that could have come across like a Facebook meme. If someone else had dropped the delivery on that and just been like, you are beautiful, it could have been one syllable different and went over like a sad trombone noise, you know?
We talked about this with T.C. DeWitt on, I think it was our Friday the 13th Vengeance episode, although it might have been Christmas Sunset. I don't know. He's been with us twice. Great guy. Listen to those episodes. But he talks about writing, which is who he is. He's a professional writer out in Los Angeles, among many other things. But he talked about that line from the prequel trilogy of Star Wars, sand. I hate sand. It gets everywhere. And he talks about, is that a bad line as written? Can it be elevated by a skillful performer? Like, you know, what is the bad writing in that? And we've talked about that a little bit. And I think everybody, and this is why there are Performance Academy Award nominations for this movie. This is why people were angry that there weren't more. And it's because they take the stupidest dialogue and make it work so well.
Well, like the sand thing, like all it would have taken would be to instead of have that be like a dead-eyed monologue into the camera, show Anakin like looking at people he was looking down on when he said the line, so that he would subtly be comparing people to the grains of sand or something. If he was looking at the citizens of Tatooine or something when he said it gets everywhere and works its way in, and you know, and it indicated that he was starting to have class traitor thoughts. You could have done something with it. But what I thought was really interesting about that scene is it hammers home something that does kind of defang the movie. The whole time, stereotypical Barbie, Margot Robbie's particular Barbie, is like very uncatty. Like she's whether there are 3 or 93, she just really does like all the women she meets in the real world, and, you know, unless they do something very deliberately mean, you know. I'm not sure anybody even does to her. So I guess there's the cops that arrest them at one point. The scene where they rollerblade out into the real world in their like hypercolor Dixie cup pattern 80s stuff was pretty funny. And the dialogue there where like the role reversal has started and she's like, what is the sense I feel? It is like a generally negative emotion, but not about anything in particular. I'm not used to this. You know, she's like, I feel like a kind of a menace with maybe like an unspecified, you know, sexual overtone. And Ken is like, I don't feel the menace or the sexual overtone. You know, that's stuff that if it had been read to the camera dead-eyed and diegetically, that would have fallen flat. You know, it's not that it's bad material, it's that it required a delivery. Everyone thinks this composite thing called a movie is their little piece of it. And that's actually what I appreciate about that conversation with TC, because he understood that it's a team sport. The writers and the actors and the visual team all need each other, and they can all ruin each other's day. Imagine if just the effects in the thing were one step cornier. Imagine if the effects in the thing were as corny as the effects in Big Trouble in Little China, the thing would not have worked. It was an exact case of like knowing your boundaries, you know? That's what fascinates me about movie making, and also what fascinates me about the fact that like the end product is a 2-hour thing that is almost doomed to sort of abridge something, you know, the brevity that forces on you, which is like one thing I'll say for the old strict 140 character, what I'm calling it shitter now, which is a portmanteau of X and Twitter. One thing I appreciated about early Twitter is like tweeting did make you right, like Hemingway. You were like, do I really need to say and then, or can I say then? The best movies, as opposed to the best books or plays or what have you, takes advantage of the fact that it is a mix of words and images to bring things across faster and more elegantly than if they were, you know, simply yammered about in text, right? I think this is trading on that a lot here, and I think it did it very successfully. But it sounds like you were a little cooler on it than me. What are your
You know, I don't think I was necessarily cool on it. I had a really good time. I enjoyed it. I'm going to give it a B plus now. I think that is going to come up. My estimation is going to increase as I watch this more, as I see more of the subtlety. Because right now, you're right. Some of these points are made with a sledgehammer. And I appreciate them. I like what's going on. But I think on a rewatch, you'll see a little more subtlety in the lead up to that sledgehammer moment. And that's what I'm looking forward to. I think in my final reckoning, to bring the episode to a close, as we are definitely approaching that line of the podcast is longer than the movie we're talking about, I think ultimately it was a good movie. I have a weird headcanon way that this wins Best Picture, and I'm kind of pulling for that to happen. I think that's going to be my head bet, not necessarily heart bet, but definitely a head bet, dark horse gamble to play for some points. I loved Kate McKinnon in this. We haven't mentioned her name as Weird Barbie. And I think we see a little of real world.
Can I please have sanitation?
I think we see a little of the real world bleeding into the fictional world when we see things like Mattel has announced that they are now making a Weird Barbie doll for consumer purchase, which I think totally misses the point of a Barbie that's been played with too hard and has seen some shit and has a mohawk now and some colorful lines colored on her face. Like, that doesn't mean anything when you give that to me already in the box. And so I think, once again, Mattel and Greta Gerwig may not be on the same page, but that's kind of what I love about this movie is, like, it's like when we were, I can't remember the name that it actually came out under, but when we saw it at Festival, was called The Vice Guide to Bigfoot, which we found out was made without the participation of the former news site Vice, and was very much a lampoon of their kind of journalism, and was released under the title 15 Things You Didn't Know About Bigfoot, parenthesis, number one will blow your mind, parenthesis. To me, it works. It gets the point across, but Vice Guide to Bigfoot was such an exquisite, beautiful title. The problem is they weren't working with Vice. Greta Gerwig was working with Mattel and found the exact amount of criticism against Mattel, against Barbie, against this property and this franchise without stepping over and pissing people off. And I think that in and of itself is an art. All of that said, this is also not a franchise movie. I don't think Greta Gerwig is shaking Noah Baumbach awake in the night and saying, baby, I've got a great idea for the sequel. As an audience member, I'm not clamoring for a sequel. This is literally the textbook definition of everything we had to say we put out in this first movie. This is not Marvel, this is not Star Wars, this is not DC. This was a one-off, and prove me wrong, please, Greta Gerwig, if you got one in you. But I think this is a movie that would suffer under a franchise as it became the thing that it was lampooning. So to that degree, I don't know if it worked.
This is not a horse that should be beaten.
No, I think this was beautiful.
This is something you got away with one time.
Exactly, I think it was beautiful, and like, immediately after kind of the initial fervor over, oh my God, Greta Gerwig of Lady Bird and Little Women is directing Barbie, WTF, and another company at another film studio announced Polly Pocket as directed by Lena Dunham. Now, on paper, tackles nostalgic childhood toy. I see the overlap, but again, I think they missed the point, because I am in line to see Greta Gerwig's Barbie. I am not interested in Lena Dunham's Polly Pocket at all.
That sounds like a Not the Onion situation there. Like, I couldn't even believe that was real.
Right? I saw Tiny Furniture at Festival. Like, that was one of her earliest movies.
And even then, I was like, I don't know. Like, it was well made. Like, people seem to enjoy it. I'm seeing a lot of clapping hands and nodding heads as Lena Dunham approaches the podium to do a Q&A. I don't know how I felt about that. And then I watched, like, 3 episodes of Girls, and I'm like, I don't know how I feel about this. And I just don't know that Lena Dunham has the voice to give gravitas to such a shallow property, not only as Barbie, which has the gravitas of history behind it, but as Polly Pocket, which Barbie preceded by 20 or 30 years. And I think it's just another example of, oh, hey, they addressed this in the movie, the fact that the boardroom full of men is totally taking the wrong message away from this trend and is seizing on the wrong thing, and then it's just immediately playing out in real life before the actual Barbie movie comes out. I thought that was hilarious. But anyways, Matt, we were digressing heavily there. What are your final thoughts on the movie?
I don't know that I have any further and more unique final thoughts. I think we're kind of in the, and also we can't take Chris's copyright on the final thought system.
Oh, that's true. Tune in to oneofus.net Screener Squad for more.
Geeks, nerds, devotees of all worlds, lend me your ears. A community of inclusion and passion awaits you at oneofus.net. Movie and music reviews, debates on books and beer, deep dives into comics and games. There's something for everyone because everyone loves something. Podcast post daily with subscriptions, you get video content as well. All are welcome, because in this world of fandom and fanaticism, all of us are in this together. Your love of pop culture and entertainment makes you one of us already. So join us today at oneofus.net.
I figure if we give him a plug, it's okay if we steal one.
I agree that this is lightning in a bottle, and attempts to repeat this over much are doomed to failure. I hope that they appreciate the one good one they got out of it and don't try to make it the BCU, you know, because that would be a mistake.
Well, and that's really my criticism, is that the A story here, the superficial A story of Barbie's not getting along in her world, she goes to the real world, she comes back, that was not, the Barbie world and Barbie rules are not the most interesting part of this movie for me. I really liked the subtext. I liked the allegory. I liked what this was saying. In literal subtext, under the text. Exploring more of the Barbie world and seeing how Barbies work and how Alan fits in and politically what does it mean for a Ken to do this. Like, that I didn't care as much for. And I think that's really the only direction we could take it, unless we just want to rehash some old shit from the first movie. And so, yeah, a sequel on this seems totally fripperous and unnecessary.
Well, for sure. And then the other thing is, like, I liked some of those gags as gags, you know, like her drinking out of the Barbie milk and all that stuff. That was funny. That stuff will not work more than 4 times, you know. I think this needs to be a take your dub, as the kids say, and don't go back to this well too much, you know. Number wise, I'm going to give it trying to think what the highest grade I've given out on here is, so I don't go too crazy. But I'm going to give this a 87.
The question knocking on the back of my mind, keeping in mind that this is not a criticism because I'm comparing it to one of the greatest films ever made. But when we talked about Citizen Kane on the Nighthawks podcast, it was a movie that I had to kind of qualify, where it's like, it's a really good movie, but to fully appreciate it, you're going to have a lot of context. I don't know that that's necessarily true of Barbie, but it might be true of Barbie in about 20 or 30 years. I hope it's true in 20 or 30 years.
That is one very fair criticism, is I don't think this movie was really per se marketed at kids. This is plainly marketed at the, you know, several generations of 18 and up women that have had Barbie, you know, foisted upon them over the decades. But I will say that this maybe fails like the test of some of the, like, I'm trying to think like a good example of like a, you know, some of the duality you see in, like, say, a Pixar movie, where there is enough snappy writing and enough sort of adult Easter eggs to keep an adult engaged, and also enough that if you strip it of all of those subtextual things, still enough fun for a younger person to watch. I do think if you really did bring like a 10 or 11 year old to this, they might be like, the fuck was that? You know, well, hopefully they'd say, what the fudge, you know, cheese and rice. That was heavy handed. And I don't think they marketed it deceptively or anything. The trailer was very clear that it was a pretty satirical movie. But I do think if somewhere out there in Des Moines, there has to be a out of touch mom that drug her 11 or 12 year old daughter to this and
drug their kid to Cool World.
The kid was probably not that impressed, unless the kid was awesome. Like if we had a young Daria Morgendorfer
or a young Matt who was drugged to Cool World off. By his mother.
I was having a good time till we left.
All right, Matt. Well, that's about going to wrap it up for me. Anything else from you?
I'm good to go. We didn't do the traditional if then sort of segment.
Oh, that's true.
I'm going to replug Poor Things, because I think it's actually the perfect. I think that and this go together like steak and wine, you know, or maybe hamburgers and scotch.
Do you foresee that being a problem come Oscar voting time when it comes time to pick one or the other?
I think based on the tastes of the Academy, I feel like Barbie will get a few technical awards. Poor Things will smoke it in anything that they're both up for.
See, I have a theory.
Which I know is kind of a bold claim, but watch Poor Things and tell me I'm wrong.
I have a theory that the snub for Greta Gerwig in the Best Director category is going to handicap Barbie up a little bit in Best Picture. I think it's not going to be a lot of people.
What are the other Best Picture noms?
But I think it's going to lead on number twos. And if we split that number one slot, I think Barbie could sneak in there. Other nominees include Oppenheimer, The Holdovers, American Fiction, Zone of Interest, Poor Things, Past Lives.
I need to go watch Zone of Interest.
Anatomy of a Fall, Maestro, and Marty, your movie's still too fucking long, Killers of the Flower Moon.
I'm going to be honest. I think I go Poor Things here. Yeah, getting a pregame in it just a little bit.
Well, I would love it if
Killers of the Flower Moon had everything it needed. The Holdovers is still I haven't seen it, but it's a talkie comedy. It's kind of a long shot. So I don't know. It could win on the auspices of, like a My Dinner with Andre type. But I don't see Killers of the Flower Moon really getting it done. Came out too early in the year. If a politicized historical drama is going to win, it's going to be Oppenheimer.
Well, Matt, I don't know if we'll be back for our Oscar coverage or not. We're certainly going to try, but there's a little preview if we don't.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, Matt, I don't know if I've ever been good enough. I'm a little bit rusty. And I think my head is caving in. And I don't know if I've ever been really loved by a hand that's touched me. And I feel like something's gonna give. And I wanna push you around. Well, I will.
Well,
I will.
You can't, Trevor. That's not how kinetics works. You'll just push yourself backwards. You should get real low.
Sweep the leg. Well, folks, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Nighthawks Podcast.
This is almost morning.
By the way, can I also say that there was a great amount of restraint and it played very well, that at no point during this movie, from beginning of the film to the end credits, we never hear Aqua's Barbie Girl.
Is that good?
I think so. I think that everybody expected it. Everybody wanted it to happen, and they said, nah.
We actually neglected to mention
Helen Mirren.
That the wry voice of the interactive narrator is Helen Mirren, and at one point, like, Margot Robbie says, like, everybody feels ugly sometimes, and she stops the movie to go, like, dear cast and crew, if you want to make this point, you don't cast Margot Robbie.
The fight that I do have a dog in, what we've been doing lately, it hasn't been the podcast. We apologize.
I apologize.
Shut the fuck up! Both of us, like, coincidentally watched Deadwood just within the last 24 hours, so you'll have to forgive us the occasional reference.
The female breast has lost all allure for me, Jane.
Bosom mean tit. Same thing.
It's set in Italy because the full moon guy has a castle we can use.
Well, I actually misspoke. There are only three Missing in Action movies. There's Missing in Action, there's the prequel, Missing in Action 2, The Beginning, and the sequel, Missing in Action 3. All of them released in the 80s, starring one Chuck Norris, and produced
isn't there
by Cannon
one,
Films.
Isn't there another sidequel called Missing in Action, colon, Braddock?
There is. The sequel is Braddock, Missing in Action 3.
Oh, okay. So, all right. I wasn't huffing gas. I haven't lost my grasp on the Missing in Action continuity. I could sing the Scatman and take it back. Steve-dee-dee-dee-dee-dup-doo-wop-wop. Dup-doo-wop-wop. Steve-dee-dee-dee-dee-dup-doo-wop-wop. Dup-doo-wop-wop. Everybody stutters one way or the other, so check out my message to you.
The Scatman can do it, so can you.
And switch decks, the groove is in the heart.